Hello, my name is Hayden Thompson and welcome to the Pack Heavy Podcast. Now, this show is really for anyone in the hospitality and food manufacturing industries that uses flexible packaging to get their products to market. Here, I'll be talking about everything food packaging and providing you with the information and knowledge that you need to get the right food package into your hands and into the hands of your consumer. I'm really excited to be interviewing guests just like you who have traveled the path that you're on so that you can learn from their successes and failures and engage in the mindset required to go all in on your vision. Now, I personally call this mindset the pack heavy mentality, and it is driven by deliberate actions such as making the decision to go all in on your vision for your business. So I'm talking about gathering market intelligence, putting a strong plan in place, organizing the appropriate resources, and then executing on your strategy with precision. So if you're packing heavy on your vision, you're definitely in the right place, and I'm really excited to have you here. Good morning and welcome to episode number 8 of the Pack Heavy Podcast. On today's episode, I'm excited to have our Food Pack GM, John Funcombe, here with me to have a conversation with Kelly Williams, who is a sustainability strategist at NatureFlex by Foodamura. Today's conversation is going to be primarily focused on the current climate we find ourselves in through the lens of what sustainability means in the flexible packaging world, end-of-life systems like compostability and recyclability of plastic structures, and also the future technology and solutions that are in the pipeline for us all. But before we kick it off, I want to give a little introduction to Kelly here. Now, Kelly has a chemical engineering degree and 20 plus years of experience in the label and flexible packaging industries across almost every core area imaginable. In 2013, Kelly joined HP Indigo to help bring the Indigo 2000 digital press to the North American flexible packaging market, which we touched on a little during episode 4 with Mikhail when we chatted about digital versus rotoprint methods. Now, Kelly is a sustainability strategist geared towards the future of flexible packaging, including how brands will make compostable packaging a reality for their consumers. So thanks for taking the time to join me here today, gents.
Absolutely. Thanks, Hayden.
Yeah, no worries. Cool. So Kelly, why don't we kick off by, if you could just give us a little bit of information and a little bit of detail on exactly what you do at NatureFlex and what a cellulose film is and sort of what specifically it is that sets Foodamura apart from everyone else in the flexible packaging world.
Yes, I can do that. So not many people know what NatureFlex is. A lot of brands have probably heard the name, but NatureFlex represents what used to be historically known as cellophane. Cellophane goes back to the early 1900s. It was the first transparent packaging film used in the world. It's based on wood pulp, so it's literally transparent paper from all practical purposes. And it's what allowed the general store to make that transition into a grocery store where perishable foods could be packaged and have a shelf life for that food product so you could actually see the product. And it was in the late, you know, early mid 70s into the early 80s that most of the cellophane was replaced by what's now the fossil plastics that are becoming quite the issue. So for example, Frito-Lay stopped using cellophane to make their potato chip bags in 1979, moving to the more convenient, lower cost, higher speed running polypropylene. And of course, now that's kind of one of the problems that we have. So cellophane is a naturally bio-based material that is everything. It's industrially compostable, it's home compostable, it's marine degradable. It pretty much checks all of those boxes.
Awesome. So yeah, obviously that's a pretty exciting technology that we have a lot of access to and or is becoming more accessible out in the world. I guess a good place to also start would to sort of talk about, you know, what's driving compostability versus recyclability in this world at the moment, because from our perspective, there seem to be sort of two conversations that, you know, come across our desk almost daily when we have a prospect or an existing customer come our way. And, you know, I think that it's everybody's genuinely trying to do the right thing by the environment and trying to make really good decisions for their business. But they seem to be coming across a few hurdles when it comes to flexible packaging. So you just mentioned the fact that, you know, cellophane has sort of shifted more into that space of fossil fuel. Generally speaking, you know, that people have got two areas that they could sort of focus on when it comes to end of life cycles for plastic. Can you take us a little bit through, you know, the difference between compostability and recyclability and sort of the debate and discussion around that?
Yeah, and there's definitely a debate and discussion and a lot of trying to understand really what because they both have benefits and complications, right? So let's talk about recycling first.
Yeah.
Recycling, well, let me first start with just strictly flexible packaging perspective, okay? Flexible packaging has been growing year over year for decades, right? If you see it in the grocery store, you see glass bottles going to spouted pouches, you see bags, and so flexible packaging, if I were to summarize a statement that really no one can argue with, is you can't sustain 8 billion people without packaged consumer goods. And you can't have packaged consumer goods without flexible packaging, because its benefits are so established, and it's lightweight. You can produce in one area and ship it to another, the adaptability and the flexibility to do a lot of different formats with it. All of those things are absolutely critical. But when flexible packaging came to the market, no one thought about the one aspect that we're all talking about today, which is the end of life of that package and what happens to it. Its sustainability benefits were so overwhelmingly positive versus rigid packaging that no one really thought about what happens after that. And I was on that side. You know, I was with the plastics industry bringing these solutions to market, and we all knew this, but no one at that time predicted to see what we see today. No one predicted that to be the case. So recycling is a bit of a misnomer, right? Because a potato chip bag's never going to become another potato chip bag. It simply can't. Food waste alone prevents that from happening. So when we use the term recycling, we're really not talking about recycling. We're really talking about repurposing. Hmm. And the problem with repurposing flexibles is the material recovery facilities that are set up to take what's in your recycle can that you put at the curb as a consumer, that can, or the people that take that can, they're not set up for flexible films. They're set up for rigid plastics and paper and paperboard. So even if you materially make something quote unquote recyclable, and I'll explain what that means in a moment, if they don't remove it, it contaminates the paper stream. So that entire infrastructure is not set up for flexible films, period, whether or not they're recyclable or not. So to be considered recyclable, what that means is, from a material perspective, it's very similar to what's used to make a detergent bottle or a milk jug. So it's got a lot of a higher density polyethylene in it. So materially, making it similar to that is what quote unquote recyclability is, but it's really repurposing. And if you think about flexible packaging, think about how many flexible packages the average person touches every day, whether it's a granola bar or a bag of nuts or whatever it is. That lightweight flexible package, if you can collect it, where's it going to go? What's it going to be turned into? And it's going to go into park benches and maybe a component in a dog frisbee, right? Mm. I mean, you're not making, you're downgrading where it's being used, or you're going to burn it into fuel, which has its own complications. There's talk about chemically recycling, which has its own set of complications. So then now if we move over to, okay, well, we have a food waste problem in the world. So as we start to legislate the movement of food waste to compost, why doesn't packaging just ride along with it, you know, and become part of that? So that would be what I would call organically recyclable. And in reality, that can be done today, but that has its own infrastructure complications, right?
Yeah, that's what we're finding here locally as well. Yeah, exactly that.
What brands don't realize is today they can get packaging that lets them have their cake, but the earth can eat it too. And what I mean by that is, if I give you two stand-up pouches, one is based on fossil plastics and one is based on compostable materials, it's very difficult to tell the difference. So how would a composter know the difference? So you kind of have a bit of a complex situation on both sides of it. It just, what's the logical solution to flexible packaging in particular? And I think largely we're going to see it more and more moving towards compostables. And we're seeing that today.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Like I suggested, like we have so many people come into our office and have the conversation about what sustainability means in the flexible packaging space. And I can only really speak locally, and we're based in Vancouver, BC. And, you know, we just don't have the infrastructure, as you were suggesting, to be able to put a lot of these compostable structures into a industrial facility. They're not going to accept them. So that sort of renders that end of life cycle kind of useless here. And it really only opens up the opportunity for backyard compostable. So if we were to talk about the infrastructure to support the compostability component, what specific infrastructure would be required?
Well, I think we have it now. I mean, yep. Industrial compost centers just in the United States, I think we're over 5,400 just in the US alone.
Yeah.
So they're out there and they're profitable businesses. They don't have very fat margins, of course, but you know, I've met with composters that are sold out for 9 months. I don't know a single material recovery facility that can say that about repurposing mixed plastics, where virgin is just as cost effective as using recycled content. But they still are worried about taking packaging. There's still a lot of confusion. They just want to make sure that it breaks down. So the difference, a lot of people get confused about what is biodegradable versus compostable.
Yeah. Well,
biodegradable got a lot of bad publicity early on because companies were marketing these additives that you can put into conventional fossil plastics that aren't making it biodegrade. They're making it environmentally degrade faster. So what you're doing is you're accelerating the conversion of that plastic film into microplastics.
Oh, yeah.
So it looks like it's disappearing, but you're really just speeding up at what would otherwise take a couple hundred years to probably do. So biodegradable is a bit of a term that you want to try to stay away from. Compostable represents a man-made system to take organic material and wood-based products and turn it into humus, which is a soil repair. It's a soil additive. It provides nutrition and water management. It's a very valuable material for farmers, for land development. And the only concern with and there's specifications and requirement, you know, so there's certain things you have to do. For example, for industrial, within 12 weeks you have to demonstrate that 90% of that material turns into organic CO2 in that period of time. Mm-hmm. And it physically disintegrates into, so nothing is left on a screen, you know, a 2 millimeter mesh, no more than 10% of that package can remain on that screen. So that's a pretty stringent requirement. I mean, we're designing high barrier functional packaging that has to break down faster than the leaves in your backyard, right? But that's the requirement, and we're there and we're doing that. But every composter operates their process differently. So just because you pass certification, the composter wants to make sure that what they're getting is still going to break down that time frame. So there's still a lot of, I guess I'd say, learning curve involved in it that's still going on.
Kelly, what kind of ideas are being floated around so that industrial composters have some reassurance that the packages that they're being provided with are the appropriate structures to work in their facilities? I mean, we've seen what the Sustainable Packaging Coalition is doing or is attempting to do as it relates to implementing symbols that clients would be mandated to have on their package should they want to participate in that program. So that's a visible symbol that they can use to identify that, in theory, the structure is meeting the requirements of their recyclability. Are they doing something similar in the composting space or in the industrial composting space specifically?
A few things are going on. The state of Washington just passed a law that says, I think it begins in 2022, that you have to have a third party logo or identification on the package if it's compostable. California's got similar legislation being reviewed. So I think that's going to continue to play out. And you know, we're members of the BPI, which is the Biodegradable Products Institute. So we're heavily active in that side of the legislative and activity as well, just to make sure that the politicians that are writing these laws, that they're taking all of the facts into consideration when they do it, because it's easy to think you're doing the right thing. It actually becomes more confusing for brands and composters. But ultimately, that's where we see it going, is you're going to start to make it easier to distinguish between the two. And then one of the ways in which to demonstrate that even though this, you know, this printed package has passed all the certification, one of the ways that we see being able to demonstrate that it actually breaks down is through the Composters Manufacturing Alliance, or CMA. So CMA represents, I'm guessing here, somewhere between 20 and 30 composters in North America that, because there's different types, there's windrow, there's pile, static pile, there's different types of compost depending on what region of North America you're in.
Yeah.
So if you get CMA certified, that means they've tested your package and all the different types of compost. And that means a lot to composters because they know that it's actually broken down in an industrial facility. So I think that's like that kind of that added confidence that this package will break down. Well, now you have the problem of, well, how do you know that that tested product is coming from a consumer's bin to your pile, right? So where you see a lot of composters starting to do work is they're working directly with grocery store chains, fast food retailers, where they know what they're getting. That's why some of the bigger brands that are focusing on closed loop systems like sporting events and things where you can collect. So what's going to the composter, they have confidence that it's what it should be. So they're more comfortable putting it into the pile. Getting it from a consumer's pantry into compost that goes then to these 5,400 plus composters, I think it's just going to take more time to demonstrate that, to build the confidence, which is why I came up with the term earth digestible to help in that conversation. So when I say earth digestible, what I mean is let's always consider certification. Let's always consider those things. But what we're talking about, there's so much focus on landfill and what goes to landfill. And in my personal view, the earth doesn't care. I'm not worried about what makes it to the landfill. I'm worried about what inevitably escapes getting to the landfill. And of the 14 trillion pounds of plastics we've produced since 1950, where half of that's been in the last 20 years, an awful lot of that escapes collection. That's what I'm worried about. So just because it's industrially compostable and maybe it's not home compostable, it's still earth digestible. It's still made out of materials that the earth's microorganisms will consider a food source. And those microorganisms exist everywhere except deserts and glaciers. It's in the oceans, it's in the rivers, it's in the ditch along the highway, and it's in your controlled environment, which is the industrial compost centers.
So if NatureFlex were to find its way to a landfill, what kind of degradation can we see from that structure in that environment?
Great question. We get that often. And there hasn't been a lot of study on it, mainly because that's an even more dynamic environment than an industrial compost, right? So with an industrial compost, you have a hurricane blow into the Gulf Coast. Well, those next 3 months, those are going to be hot piles in the Southeast because there's a lot of woody material in that compost, right? So any given moment, a compost makeup is going to be a little bit different. And in that particular situation, this is a system designed to not break down, right? What goes into a landfill is designed to not break down, to not turn into methane gas. So once the environment is conducive to either aerobic or anaerobic breakdown, these materials are going to break down faster than a fossil plastic when those conditions present themselves. Otherwise, it's like the hot dog that's been there for 50 years. It's not going to break down until the environment allows it to break down.
Yeah, I've seen those photos as well of like, bananas and vegetables and stuff that ends up in the waste, in the regular waste stream. And they're pretty well mummified, that's for sure. I'm a little confused, and maybe you could shed a bit of light on it as well, because we have these regular industrial facilities here in BC, but they're not accepting these industrial composting or compostable structures. So what do you think the hurdle is there?
I think, again, it's learning curve and confidence, knowing that it's going to break down, and discerning, being able to discern between fossil plastics and compostable plastics, because when I hand them to you, so good thing, bad thing, right? I can give you a package that looks and feels just like what you're using today, only it's earth digestible. And how do you distinguish? So which is why, you know, the law in Washington and what California is looking at are all steps in the right direction to try to help with that. But I think it's just going to come with time. My personal view is as food waste starts to be forced to move to composting centers, it's going to be a lot easier for packaging to go with it.
Hmm.
And yeah, I assume we'll get into to the package manufacturing side in a little bit later, but I do think packaging presents an opportunity to drive real change at the legislative level. I call it bringing truth to power, the power of the package to get the, you know, if you want, so I'll just use an example. If let's take a leader like Patagonia, you know, Patagonia is well known for their environmental awareness. They've got food products. So if any given moment they want to put on their bars, their energy bars, marketing to this effect and through digital printing and other methods, that package is uniquely scannable. So the consumer literally scans that package and it takes them to a place not to enter their information because of technology. It you're just validating the accuracy of the information it already knows about you, right? And you say, yeah, I support the state of California subsidizing industrial composting centers to accept packaging, meaning they need some subsidies to invest in the filtering equipment to make sure they can remove at the tail end what doesn't break down so they can either remove it or recirculate it back. Something as simple as that. And just like that, you've got 20 million signatures saying, hey, we want you to do this. And you can do all of that through the power of packaging. Because to me, you can't sell packaged consumer goods without the package. So why is the package a cost center? It's never been a cost center. It's necessary to sell a product. There's nothing preventing that package from being a profit center, to be a physical form of social media that can engage the relationship between a brand's social purpose and their consumers, to get those signatures to drive real action.
Yeah, got you. And I guess you're leveraging digital print methods and the capability of the technology around that sort of area. Is that true?
Certainly digital, yep. But there's even technologies that exist for, there's a company called Into, INTO, that it's the static flexo printed graphic and it's just got a viewer, you connect to it and it takes you to a place that the brand can have now a relationship directly with you. So digital, to me, I'm a big fan of digital. I think it's the future of flexible packaging. For sure, but it doesn't even have to be digital to start taking advantage of rethinking packaging as a profit center versus a line item in your balance sheet.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. So, I mean, compostability, it sounds like a no-brainer to me. And I mean, obviously you're coming from NatureFlex and you've got your whole business built around the idea of, you know, earth digestible structures and so on. But the recyclability component just keeps on coming up in conversation. So who's pushing that conversation? Like who's pushing the agenda in this space?
Well, let's look at the plastics industry, right?
Yeah.
They're big and they're heavily subsidized. And what most people aren't thinking about is big oil is big plastic. And big oil is quickly becoming truly big plastic. The one of the energy organizations says by 2050, there's going to be more fossil fuels used to make plastics than for fuels. So between big oil / big plastic and big soda, there's a lot of influence there to keep status quo. So they may feel the same way that mechanical recycling or chemical recycling is a convenient fallacy, but there's also $400 billion worth of expansions being planned globally to expand plastics. I live in the state of Ohio, and Ohio recently passed a law banning bans, meaning no local municipality can ban anything, straws, shopping bags, or anything. And you think, well, why would the state of Ohio be so concerned about that? Well, the plastics industry has people lobbying for those things because they're trying to preserve their livelihood, and you can't blame them for doing that. But, you know, so there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of confusion. And if it was as simple as recycling, everybody would be for it because it's more like what we do today. But the reality is you can't repurpose what you can't collect. Think about it. We can't even make flexible packaging that stays in one piece when we open it. Open a bag of chips, it comes off in two pieces. And what are you going to do with it? Collect it and then take it back to the store? To do what? It either goes to landfill or eventually some deck boards might be made out of it.
And that just doesn't seem
sustainable long term.
Yeah. Go, John.
Well, and it's just not that believable. And it's you just do a little bit of research and you come across a lot of contradictory statements and a lot of greenwashing. And I'm just curious why you feel that, you know, some of these large brands or bigger retailers are promoting this message. I can understand the perspective of the oil producers because they've got a financial interest in it. But, you know, for larger retailers to, you know, implement their sustainability goals for 2025 built around the recyclability of plastic, it seems like it's very misleading. And I think it's confusing a lot of, you know, businesses, specifically small businesses that are looking to, you know, sell their product through these distribution channels.
I agree with you. And it's, and you have to really look at the current moment in time when you look at how retailers view this. So for example, in the last year alone, two parts of the grocery store have become very evident on my radar of activity around looking for compostable design solutions. The entire produce section of the grocery store is starting to become aware that you're not going to recycle your way out of fresh, ready-to-eat salad mixes. Same thing with the frozen food section. One of the that entire section is very active in developing compostable solutions. So the retailers are one by one starting to realize, and then you've got some leaders, you know, Trader Joe's is one that's pretty vocal about it. You know, they believe, you know, 80% of what they sell is their own product and they want to move all of it to compostable, but wanting to and doing it, you know, those are two different things. There's a big undertaking to make that kind of transition. Now, from a legacy brand perspective, you know, when you own 50% of the snack real estate at Walmart from coast to coast, that's a lot of cheap chip bags that you have to think about. How do I increase the cost of my bag by 2 to 3x to get a more environmentally sustainable solution? It's a very difficult thing. So you kind of also have to take a look at legacy brands may currently have the majority market share, but who has the majority of market growth? It's emerging brands. And emerging brands are building very profitable businesses where they're not on a Walmart shelf. They're selling through e-commerce and other channels. And they're the ones that can, anybody can do this. The problem that they have is you don't start a food brand because you're a packaging engineer. You start a food brand because you've got a great idea and you want to bring a product to market. Packaging is one of those things you have to be worried about. And when they go to find help with packaging, they're not finding the help that they need. Or when they find somebody, they're being told what they believe they. So somebody that doesn't do this today, are they going to offer it to a new customer? They're going to offer what they do today and what they want to do today, not what they could do tomorrow.
Right.
So a lot of brands don't know that so when we have a tabletop at a food show, 8 out of 10 people that come by our tabletop can't believe that all of these products can be done in compostable solutions today. Their jaw drops because they just didn't realize it was possible. My estimate is there's $800 million worth of flexible packaging that's being outsourced to Asia, not because they're cheaper and certainly not because they're faster, but because nobody else is going to do 5 SKUs by 15,000 pouches each. Because 15 companies represent 70% of the market of flexible packaging manufacturing in North America. These guys aren't set up to do 15,000 pouch runs. So where are they going to get it? They're forced to go to Asia to get it. So there's a disconnect between packaging manufacturing and brand need as well that you have to factor in.
So let's focus on that customer. Let's focus on that brand that wants five SKUs over 15,000 pieces. Mm-hmm. What is their solution to sustainable packaging?
Well, one easy way is to let's make the move to recyclable today and keep marching down the path of better solutions later. You know, so some decisions to go recycling is because it's accessible today. And then you don't stop there because it's a never-ending journey. Others do it because they don't realize that they can put their current package into a compostable solution because they only know what they know. They don't know what they don't know.
So when you say start recycling today, are you using recycling? Composting falls into that category.
Well, recycling meaning you're using an all polyethylene package that has enough high density polyethylene in it to be compatible to detergent bottles and milk jugs. So that's what recycling means. And you can do that today knowing that it's probably not being repurposed. I'm not going to say recycled, repurposed. But it's something, you know, you're at least doing something today. And the cost difference between that versus composting, I mean, compostable, it does cost more. So you have to understand, you have to think, you know, how, so some of our brand customers have found other ways within their business to offset that cost. So from them, from a balance sheet perspective, it's a cost neutral. I think the real opportunity is to rethink packaging as a physical form of social media, as a way to engage consumers.
Yeah.
And use it differently. So then, because, you know, when digital printing first went into the label market, let's look at that great near today historical perspective. When digital printing first came into the label market, it was all about how much more expensive is it versus flexo printing. Today, no one asks that question. It's not even a question anymore.
Yeah.
More than half of the capital spend on printing assets goes to digital today. No one's asking that question anymore. And the same thing is going to happen here.
So it sounds like, you know, we need to make a decision around where the money's going to be invested in the infrastructure, whether that's going to be to support the recyclable initiatives or support the composting initiatives. Do you see one as more important than the other, or is it realistic to believe that both of those areas are going to be developed to support packaging in the recycling streams?
There is definitely activity going on in both. And I would say if I had to give you my finger in the air perspective, is that there's a growing awareness that recycling is not going to be easy. And that composting is starting to look more attractive. So there's activity in both, but again, there's a lot of political influence to make sure that a lot of the government dollars spent through Department of Energy and all these other initiatives that a lot of it's going to be directed towards finding ways to take fossil plastics and recover it in some way versus composting.
That's really interesting. I think a good place to take this conversation would to be, I'd love to ask you some hypothetical questions that are sort of relatable to our listeners. So, I mean, obviously we were just talking about sort of the barrier to entry being high minimum order quantities and also price point at this time is also a bit of a barrier as well, but that can all be worked around by, you know, multiple SKUs and also, as you were suggesting, offsetting the cost. But, you know, because there are retailers who are demanding sustainable solutions from their vendors, I'd just love to ask a couple of sort of hypothetical questions. So for example, like if we were talking liquids, so there was a soup company that was using a flexible stand-up pouch that needs a sustainable option. What would you recommend in terms of, or looking through the lens of potential laminated structures and material combinations?
So when you say soup, you mean a liquid soup?
Yeah, right? Like a liquid soup, correct. Okay. Yeah.
So what that's, you probably picked the perfect one to start with, because
yeah,
one of the absolute challenges of compostable materials,
yep,
is in order for a material to become a food source for microorganisms, it needs microorganisms and it's going to need moisture,
yep,
and oxygen.
Yeah.
So all compostable materials are always going to have some level of sensitivity to strict straight moisture. I'm not talking about incidental moisture. So you can put wet produce in a package. You can put something that's aqueous and freeze it and it's fine. But if you put something that's aqueous in a package, it's going to struggle. That technology, we're not there today. But let's talk about what I am seeing brands doing. And I think this is a testament to the awareness of the path. And remind me to mention Ellen MacArthur Foundation if I forget to at the end of this, but what I'm seeing is some brands are taking even iconic categories and they're rethinking that product. So for example, it took P&G years to convince Americans that they don't have to wash their body with a bar of soap. They can use a liquid gel and a loofah or a, you know, a washcloth. So now a lot of people shower with shower gel. Well, putting that product in a liquid form, you need a bottle or a highly over-engineered fossil-based plastic pouch with a spout on it. But if we rethink the product and make it a bar again, now you can use a single layer of Nature Flex to wrap your product. So we're seeing some brands come out with shampoo bars where you're going to wash your hair with a bar. You're seeing it in toothpaste, the little tablets that you just throw into your mouth and start brushing.
Wow.
So you don't need to make that you don't need that sustainability nightmare of a toothpaste tube if you rethink the product itself. So what you're going to see is rethinking. So you're and I'm working on some of these projects right now. A freeze-dried soup. So this it's still the same soup. It just hasn't been constituted in water yet. You do that later. So now you can put that product into a sustainable package.
Mm-hmm. Got ya. Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Things like retort are always going to be challenges. Right. Now on the Ellen MacArthur part, I think it's worth noting. So if you're not familiar with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, it's basically a challenge that brands and retailers are committing to that by 2025, a certain percentage of your business is going to be either recyclable, reusable, or compostable. And people are realizing that says or compostable. Because the problem is when you get into complex structures like condiments in a sachet, and because of COVID, we're seeing that increasing, right? You're not seeing community condiments on the table at restaurants. You're seeing it going back, you know, so we're seeing actually an increase in single-use packaging because of COVID, but you're not going to put ketchup into an all polyethylene sachet. So compostable actually represents a because there's not just one material. There's different materials, different biopolymers, different cellulosic. So you can put together more complex structures from the compostable side than you can with an all polyethylene solution. So some of this, and then also to get credit under Ellen MacArthur Foundation, just because you make your package recyclable, if you can't demonstrate that it's actually being recycled or repurposed, you don't get credit for that. So just making it that way, you have to demonstrate that it actually is being done. So a lot of those scorecards are not looking real good, and 2025 is right around the corner.
Yeah, it'll be here before you know it, hey.
So that being said, is part of the strategy with these larger retailers that the more companies and vendors that they can convince to convert their packaging to a recyclable structure will put the appropriate amount of pressure on the municipalities and the governments to invest in the infrastructure to accommodate it? Because otherwise, I don't see how they're going to achieve these objectives by 2025 if they're suggesting to their vendors and suppliers to move towards a structure that right now cannot enter the recyclable stream.
There's probably more than one. I know of one that is a sponsored research program among some pretty large retailers and brands to redesign the MRF, the material recovery facilities are called MRFs. Basically the MRF of the future, how do you redesign the MRF to do this and take these mixed plastics and turn them into something useful. But again, what we're talking about turning them into are roofing tiles and deck boards. But a way to at least handle them, period. A lot of brands are saying, well, we're going to support store take back or loop, you know, loop where you can reuse the container. Store take back is a stopgap. I mean, we know that that's being collected and most likely it's ending up in a landfill anyway, but at least it's something to do today, knowing that it's not where you stop. It's where it's just a stop along the trajectory. But there is activity on rethinking the MRF, and I don't see that slowing down because there's a lot of political pressure to find a solution on the mechanical or chemical recycling side, and that's not going to go away. What I am seeing is that in parallel to that, the amount of activity around interest in compostable solutions has gone up significantly and has been steadily going up. But I would say in the last year alone, it has really, really gone up.
I'm just going to go back to your hypothetical scenarios, Hayden. Yeah. If we're looking at dry goods, specifically coffee or cannabis, and we're, you know, short run, multiple SKUs, laminated, printed pouch. Mm-hmm. Do you have a suggestion or a recommendation for a sustainable structure for that type of client?
Yeah, I'm actually looking at a cannabis pouch that we just made. It may be one of the strongest compostable pouches I've ever seen. Because, you know, there's a minimum thickness requirement in California and Colorado of about 4 mil. So you make a 4 mil compostable, small single use, pouch, and it's pretty strong. So cannabis, a lot of activity in cannabis. Cannabis to me kind of represents the wine industry for digital printing, where the wine labels it's a premium product, and they afforded the high graphics that digital enabled in the beginning of the growth of digital. Cannabis and coffee represent the same. So coffee has been a strong market. Coffee and tea both have been strong markets for us for years, because it's a premium product, and there's just a lot of interest in getting that solution. So, you know, Oakland Coffee is one. If you're on the West Coast, you probably know them. You can get it at Costco and other retailers. But Oakland Coffee is a fully industrially compostable coffee bag. But if you picked it up in the store, you wouldn't know any different.
What's the structure specifically of that pouch?
I can't tell you exactly what it is, but I can tell you typically how these go, right?
Okay.
So NatureFlex, what NatureFlex represents is the outside of the package. So that's your structural film that provides the heat resistance and the mechanical processing through the forming, filling, and printing operation. And it replaces the polyester in your bigger format packages and bags, pouches and bags, or the polypropylene in a smaller format like a chip bag or a bar wrap. That's the part we replace. But NatureFlex has inherently great oxygen barrier. So you don't need to now combine it with a PE, EVOH, COX to get your high oxygen barrier for like processed meat and cheese. So you don't need to put EVOH in a beef jerky package because we provide that. And then we simply combine it with the correct biopolymer film that replaces the polyethylene on the inside. And now you've got a flexible packaging structure that in most cases doesn't require the current 3 layers of film. It only requires 2 layers of film.
Got you. So when you're talking about the biofilm, what specifically are you talking about? Because I know that there are a few different types out there.
Yeah. So on the industrial side, you know, PLA is probably the most common.
Yeah.
And everybody knows PLA is industrially compostable. It's not home compostable, but there's other materials out there such as bio PBS, polybutylene succinate, you know, say that 10 times fast, right? That's a very common one. There's thermoplastic starch. There's PHA is now coming into market pretty quickly from Danimer Scientific. There's PBAT from BASF and a brand called EcoFlex and EcoVio. Great, great options. So there's a half a dozen or so materials that can be used on the inside of the package, and we combine that with our film. And then we can also metallize our film to give even higher barrier. And a lot of people are wondering, you know, how can you metallize a film and it still be compostable? And if you think about how aluminum is made, that's used in that process, aluminum is mined from aluminum oxide. So when that atom's thick, very, very thin layer of aluminum on the film goes through the disintegration process as microorganisms eat the film, that aluminum just goes back to aluminum oxide, a naturally occurring element. So it doesn't affect the compostability requirements at all. But that's one way to get even better barrier, is to metallize that film.
Is for example, PLA, is there limitations on the thickness that film's available in? Or similar to polyethylene, can I layer that on to get the gauge that I'm looking for the overall pouch?
Great question. For compostability, you know, so you can get a compostable zipper, like a reclosable zipper for a pouch, but the compostable options that you'll find in the marketplace are a little bit thinner than what you would see in a polyethylene bag, because there is a critical thickness for which, you know, again, we've got 3 months. We have to break down faster than leaves in your backyard. So you can't have too thick of a cross section of that package. So what you generally see are highly functional zippers, but they're not as thick as what you would typically see in polyethylene. And on the actual thickness side, my general view is you see versus polyethylene, these sealant films are generally thinner than polyethylene. They function at a thinner gauge and they seal at a lower temperature, which depending on the converting operation is a benefit because you don't have to put as much heat into it to get it to seal. PLA is a particularly interesting one because to put a zipper in a pouch, if you ask a flexible packaging manufacturer or a pouch manufacturer, they're going to tell you, you need a minimum of 2.5 mils of gauge of thickness to get that to form, to get the bottom of that pouch to form and to seal a zipper into it. And I've made stand up pouches with, 0.6 mils with a zipper in it.
Wow.
Because it's a completely different material. So
Right. Generally
speaking, the solution, a compostable solution, is almost every time going to be thinner than what you're currently using. But let's look at bar wrap, for example. I spent a lot of time helping, you know, telling people, look, make sure the co-packer is on board with what you're doing. You would think brands have control over their co-packer, but strangely enough, they really don't. Co-packers on any given day can make a success fail and a failure succeed. They have to want you to succeed because they don't want to change what they're doing.
Right.
So if most of your bar wrap machines are usually 2 mils of 2 layers of polypropylene, roughly 2 mils thick. So if you think about that high-speed machine that's sealing, forming, sealing, and cutting each bar at a high speed, if they have to adjust those knives to cut something thinner, if they don't want to do that, it's not going to be a successful trial.
Right.
So co-packers to me are critical. And from my experience so far, I'd say more than half of the time, the co-packer's feeling is it runs better than what they've been running on the conventional fossil plastic side.
If they're willing to see it through.
If they're willing to see it through, they really like running it.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, what about modified atmosphere packaging and specifically vacuum packaging? There's a challenge, obviously, with puncture resistance and down gauging your films.
Yeah.
Do we have a solution to, you know, your traditional coax extruded nylon poly vacuum pouch or a laminated pouch with polyester, nylon, and polyethylene?
Yes and no, and I'll explain why it's yes and no. But let me start off by saying, take note that today's packaging is significantly over-engineered in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
A bag of chips has no business going to Mars and back and still being fresh, okay? So a lot of times brands don't know what they need, they only know what they're currently getting. I mean, we have R&D tests for packaging that are the Spanish Inquisition of tests because they're so severe, there's no other way to tell one supplier's product from another's because they're both so extremely over-engineered.
Mm.
So in that particular case, replacing that nylon EVOH polyethylene cast extruded coax and having this forming web, that's a challenge. That is a real challenge to mimic that. Can you package that product in a different way? Some cases, yes, you can. So for example, we have customers in Europe that are, you know, when you buy bacon, you know, it's in that type of pack, but it's not like a deep draw pack, but it's in that type of a package, right? That's being done today compostable. So it just depends on the specific application, whether it's there yet or not. But to put something like, trying to think of a good example, you know, like you have
smoked salmon.
Yes. So if it's not a deep draw, yes. You can pull a vacuum and you can seal it and it's going to be fresh. it's going to hold the freshness in, especially if it's frozen. But if you want to do a deep pocket, like, you know, like guacamole or something like that, that's in, got, it's got a thermoformed well in it with a lid over top.
Yeah.
Like that's something that I think would be more challenging today to get the barrier and still have that forming capability. But if it's a shallow form, I think that technology is there.
I mean, it's got to be an area that a lot of people have got their eyes on, because generally speaking, that equipment is geared towards high volume, high output uniform products. Mm-hmm. So to address that type of packaging, I think would go a long way in just sort of the overall goal around sustainable packaging.
Yep, I would agree.
John, do you have any more questions? I've actually covered off, or we've covered off, every single question that I possibly had for Callie, and I feel like we've learned a lot today. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation or to round it out?
I don't. I mean, as always, it's very educational speaking with Callie, and again, you know, I appreciate your time. I hope the listeners, Hayden, have learned a lot through this, as I know I have.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I'm going to basically go back through this podcast and take some notes here, and I'll put that in the show notes as well to sort of break it down for the listeners. But yeah, Callie, you're a wealth of information, mate, and you're definitely an asset in this world, and we'll be calling back on you again, that's for sure. And mate, the future looks bright. I really feel the future looks bright in this space. And, you know, I guess to wrap things up, do you sort of have a key message that you'd like our listeners to hear, or, you know, anything that you'd like to finish off with?
The only thing I would probably add is just, you know, think about what the word sustainability means. If you feel like we can do it forever, then it's sustainable. And I'm just not sure that there's a shop back big enough to suck up, you know, 1.8 trillion flexible packaging units globally every year and growing. We can't suck those little pieces up, you know? So what are we going to do with them if we did? So I really think you got to think about food waste and packaging, traveling with that, and being used organic in an organic cycle allows you to take. So nature's basically built all the raw materials we need. We just never needed to use them before, because this entire industry grew up when the question was, can we do it? Not should we do it? Mm-hmm. And now we're asking a lot of questions of should we do it? And what's exciting to me is the amount of global R&D that's going on, bringing these new products to market. So we're just at the beginning. I think we've actually entered the next era of human history. Just, I don't think anybody's coined it yet. So maybe I can coin it.
Do it.
We're officially in the new materials age. It's okay. All about new materials and rethinking materials. And that means borrowing from nature and recombining it in ways that do these everyday things.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. No, it's so good to hear, mate. And I'm so glad that we've got people like you in this world to influence everybody out there and, you know, give some context to the conversation, because, you know, it is a muddy conversation, as we know, isn't it, John? And, you know, we're having these conversations every day with our customers, and we're trying to orient and point people in the right direction as well. So the more information that we have on this, in this conversation, the better. And yeah, listen, mate, so you were talking about the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. Are there any other great resources out there that you recommend people go to as well?
You know, SPC is a good one, the Sustainable Packaging Coalition. I would look at CMA, the Composting Manufacturers Alliance. The USCC, the U.S. Composting Council, has got some great resources. But, you know, if you just go into Google and just start searching that conversation, you're going to find a wealth to get lost in. Mm. And just rest assured that don't let the complexity and the what appears very difficult to understand on the certification and what can I say on the package. Those are easy things. Focus right now on what do you do today? What do you want to do tomorrow? Get enough, you know, get enough research on your own to have some good questions, and then, you know, connect them to me. That's my job,
is to help with the
problems.
Great.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Kelly. So for everybody out there, if you do have any sustainability packaging questions, please shoot them our way, and we'll be able to direct them to Kelly on your behalf as well. And yeah, thank you so much for your time, Kelly and John. I appreciate it. Both, you're both busy men. And yeah, I'll catch you both again. I'd love to have you both on the show in the future again if something comes up and we think that it's relevant to the listener as well. So yeah, thank you both very much for your time.
Awesome.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Bye. Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions from today's episode or would like to know more about what I can do to help you achieve your packaging vision, you can reach me directly at hayden@thepackheavypodcast.com. You could DM me on Instagram @thepackheavypodcast, or we could also connect on LinkedIn and start a conversation there. I'll see you next week.